We'll stand for the reading of the gospel. It's the gospel text of the lection that comes in the book of Matthew. Last week, if you were here, Peter was the first to claim Jesus as the Christ, and it's the only beatitude offered to an individual by Jesus. He tells him, "Blessed are you, Simon Barjona." He calls him blessed and then hands to him the keys of heaven and hell and reminds him that he'll be the rock upon which he'll build his church. And then the text continues. From that time on, Jesus began to show his disciples he must go to Jerusalem and undergo great suffering at the hands of elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and on the third day be raised. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him and said, "God forbid this, Lord, these things must never happen to you." He turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me, for you are setting your mind not on the divine things, but on human things." Then Jesus told his disciples, "If anyone wishes to be my followers, let them deny themselves, take up their cross, and follow me. For those who wish to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake will find it. So what will it profit if they gain the whole world yet forfeit their own life? Or what will they give in return for their soul? Grass will wither and flowers will fade away, but the word of the Lord will last forever and ever." Thanks be to God. Please be seated. Chapter 16 is a roller coaster trip for Peter, from the penthouse to the outhouse in a matter of three verses, from a rock to the ridiculous, from brilliant to brute, from a spiritual rock to an incarnation snapshot of evil. Can you imagine? When I first began a new appointment years ago, I received literally on the very same day two letters. The first I opened was this encouraging, sweet, uplifting things that lifted many of my wonderful and obvious attributes as a pastor. I read it and was so very thankful. Literally, the very next anonymous letter I opened seemed to bring to the surface some alleged faults and imperfections, and said that maybe they were in the wrong church now after many years and sought to find a new place. I eased my mind that I would side with the first writer and not the second around realities. But somewhere in the middle of the night, I remember awakening and thinking, what if they're both true? What if somewhere bound up in the goodness and brokenness of me that there is a container that can hold both heaven and hell, light and dark, good and bad. Sundays are funny days. We worship and praise, then sometimes jump in the car and argue and complain. I project goodness into the life of others and then can quickly think and then do harm. I have courage here among you. I always do. I never feel afraid in this worship space. And then Sunday evening comes. I trust God here and then seem to move towards idols in the night when things become dark and restless. Humans are very strange things, are we not? Unique among the beast that we can offer language, a voice that lifts encouragement, praise, prayer, healing. Or we can denounce and misrepresent, curse, and cause pain. Out of the abundance, Jesus said, of the heart, the mouth speaks. Both good and evil, of course, revealed in the contents of the deep mystery of who we really are. We can use our power, as Peter did, to feather our own nests and worry about our own futures, or to speak realities that bring hope and meaning and purpose to others. Maybe Peter is a container of a very complex system of things of which few people dare to look into. Peter overhears his deepest and holiest purpose in a few verses, and then in fear redirects to divert to his shadow mission and reveal not only the hope of being near the kingdom of God, but also trying to sway Christ to reject the objectives of God himself. Jesus affirms Peter upon this rock. "You know this," he says. "I've got you. I'm on to you, and I love what I see." He reassures him. He gives him a new name, a new identity, and a whole realm of possibilities that would startle us to know what God could do with a wholly given, acknowledged life. And yet, in the very same moment then, Peter says something and thinks something that causes Jesus to call him Satan and to tell him to buzz off or get behind or to back far away, literally in the Greek. It had to be about a spirit, an attitude, an atmosphere that affirms in one moment that Peter could be really close to heaven and then in the next, very close to hell. Jesus' sharp and poignant rebuke of Peter is an urging that seems to connect to an adversary's whisper to Jesus all along in the temptation of his own life. Push the button of ease and escape the sacrifice and the temptations that call one to a faithful and holy life. Jesus could escape and dodge the cross. He could love the comfort of a soft sanctuary and a velvet pulpit. And Peter's dark moment comes when he protests the movement of Jesus towards the cross or the embracing of his own mission to his Father's goals. I don't blame Peter. I don't know about you. Peter likes having Jesus around. It's very convenient and comfortable. "Well, I mean, these prayers of Jesus to simply take care of me and make life easier for me and keep me in a close and safe system where everything worked out to like sort of my own goals seems to be the goal of Peter." And I get it. Peter wants to live in a world where the stock market goes up, where the kids don't offer a blemish, where the spouse always agrees, and when he's in a financial pinch, all he has to do is offer to go fishing with Jesus. He catches a fish and ganks out of its mouth a golden coin, and the world is all right again. I mean, like when you're around irritating people and you have Jesus close by physically, all he has to do is say a word and cast devils out of them and make them sort of back into their right mind, which of course is the way I would be thinking. I just think, of course he would want Jesus around to hear his joys and concerns, to bless him, feed him, and take care of him, as usually is the discourse of our normal prayers. I think I mentioned here years ago that we had a foster daughter who on her 8th birthday decided to go into the copier room and print off 500 sheets of a birthday list of what she hoped for, including ponies and pools and things like that. It was masterful. She sat at the door of our church and met worshipers with her list, and she was adorable, absolutely adorable. And she got some of the things on her list, unfortunately not the pool for the parsonage. But as I was thinking about trying to offer to Michaela, that's just not cool. There was something just sort of adorable about it until I thought, it's cute till you're 60 and still doing the same things with God. Mission leads to being outside of ourselves and to a servant attitude that partners with God, where sometime the goal would be that every member is seen not to be served, but to serve and to give their life as a ransom for the world. Mission in the church is about embracing a cross of the death of self and a brand new beginning, maybe for those who we were once not comfortable with. Mission leads to joy, heaven on earth, electricity in the parking lot, beauty and goodness and inspiration among God's people. Mission leads to the death of self and preference and leads to new fruit in life. Peter loves Jesus, but maybe in such a shallow way that he can't see Christ spending his life completely for God. When we live with closed hearts, we live with a protective shell around our self-protection and comfort that needs to be broken. The hatching of a heart happens when broken soil is tilled to allow compassion and new beginnings to come to those who believe. Jesus wants Peter to die, to be crucified, mortified, concluded. He wants Peter to emerge selfless, interested in others, less greedy and worried, generous and provisional to a world around him, even to the place of deep sacrifice that would lead Peter not only just figuratively to his own death, but literally. The prayer of a missional heart does not end with bless me, take care of my DNA, and make sure people who act like me and believe like me are okay. Jesus was worried about Peter becoming old and dead, saintless, poetless, soulless, passionless, shallow, heroless, and self-indulgent. He wanted something in Peter to emerge as wild and dangerous and unpredictable, something that promises a freedom even when he meets people with whom he would not agree. I love in Alice in Wonderland when Alice meets the cat and asks if she's mad or crazy, to which the cat replies, "Of course you're mad." When she wakes up from her dream, she asks her loving and very tender father, "I'm worried," she says, "Daddy, that I'm crazy." To which he responds, "Of course you're crazy. You've always been crazy. And yet the secret is the best people in the world are crazy. And my favorite people have always been off their rocker." It reminds me of reading Don Quixote, of this heroic, innocent lunatic, this chivalrous, compassionate nut, this loving, self-emptying wackadoodle who travels the world believing that somehow he's following God to bring healing and hope to people while he's attacking windmills. G.K. Chesterton says, "Maybe we should be more suspicious of engineers with calculators, of which preachers are guilty, than we should be for those who cut off their ears in love." Maybe, he says, as I continue to quote, "the ones who use the most logic are really the most frightening and the wildest, who love the world seen as the most insane." I think the world rejects the church today and our faith, not because we're wrong, but because sometimes we're just so boring and predictable. Christ is lightning and fire, and somehow we've channeled the lightning of his presence through a lightning rod like churchiness. Jesus turned water into wine, and we sometimes turn wine back into water for fear of what the world would say. The intoxicating wine of the Spirit into mushy grape jelly and water it down with a comfortable success image that comes from suburban Christianity that sometimes is antithetical to the real thing that Jesus offers. I think about this. The antidote for a strong infection is often a weak infection of the same strain. An introduction of a weak infection to build strength to fight an infection usually is how they come up with cures. So maybe the antidote remedy for Jesus Christ is Christian stuff. And the antidote for his noun is our adjective. There is nothing so formidable, unconquerable, and beautiful as the real church movement of God. There is nothing so boring, sleeping, and ugly as a dormant church that just seeks to make everyone comfortable, safe, sound, and similar. The church
church, obviously, we're finding out more and more, is not a building, but this movement of a love song, a love offering, and a self-sacrifice of those who dare to sing the crazy songs of Christ. Cicero, the great philosopher who lived in the Roman Empire, said, "I have given up on the gods of the Greek, for they attend to the great matters of the universe, but they've neglected the small ones." Our God of incarnation is the God of the small matters, the one who looks into the deepest hurts, the one who comes to break the image of what we thought God was like and restore it to something powerful and beautiful and new. Jesus said, "I will build my church upon this rock." He is still building today upon those of you who would embrace a cross and to see yourself be given away for the sake of Christ and those whom he loves. He would give us the keys, maybe misplaced in some days, maybe in some awkward thing where someone could say, "Where did you leave them last?" But to the very kingdom, God has given you the promise to reach real people with the healing and hope-filled message that God has come. Nothing will stop this movement. God's movement in the world can never be stopped. He says that hell will not prevail against it. His kingdom is relentless, inescapable, inevitable, and unshakable for any of you who have whispered yes. The nations will come. Justice will roll like water one day. Songs of Christ will be sung, and the church will worship, and love will win, and Christ will rule. We can relax. It's okay. Even if it looks like the score is against, Christ promises that one day pride will be melted and sins will be burned, and eternal love will reveal its secret in the hearts of all who truly lost themselves for his sake. Many of you, when you look at the aisle of a church, I think of weddings, and just next week someone will walk down this aisle and they'll say these crazy, ridiculous words to each other, that they will love and comfort and honor, that they will cherish each other and be faithful to each other always. They'll say these things that make them mad as hatters in a world of convenience, that they will do these things, not just when they feel like it, but for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, and even in sickness and in health. And when they don't feel like it at all, they'll just promise to do it anyhow. In other words, the vows they make at marriage will hardly be more extravagant than any other, save that they give to Christ. They will bind their lives together for each other. And one asks sometimes, on dark days of marriage, "What do you get for this?" And the answer is, the other. You get the other. You get them, and they get you. What do you get for giving your life to Christ? Maybe Christ, which is the best gift of all. Today, I long and ache for a day when safety is released and preference of comfort is given away, and an intimacy with the Father to travel a new road emerges among his people, a hard road, a narrow road, a sacrificial road, where we eventually give away our anger and selfishness and preference and comfort, even if the songs that are sung are not the ones we like best, still we will worship. I feel sad for Jesus to have friends like me and like Peter. I think that the Inquisition and witch hunts and crusades and defense of slavery and imperialism and resistance to science and wars of religion have done its harm. Judgmentalism and intolerance and bigotry have gone on for centuries within the life of the church. Scandals of money and sex are not new in the news. All the time, I think, Jesus' followers cause him way more trouble and pain than his enemies do. But on this day, we will celebrate that somehow Christ saw in Peter the great and beautiful hope of a royal dignity, of a new beginning, that every time Peter could let go of himself and remember who it is he belongs to and who it is he truly loves, something happens where we begin to see the dignity of God, not only in our own life, but then in the lives of others. Martin Luther King Jr. one time said, there are gradations of talent, color, strength, intelligence, and beauty, but there are no gradations in the image of God. Think about that. There's just a bestowed worth on everything and everyone that God has made. I'll close with this. When our Leah, our oldest, was a little girl, she had the ugliest doll in the whole wide world. She named it Quincy. Its head was too big, its hair was tangled. It looked like something from a horror movie. One eye didn't shut right after it had been loved well, and it got dirty, and we tried washing it. What only made it worse, Quincy was the weirdest looking doll I'd ever seen. When she would drag it with her, even when she was too old to drag dolls, one time I said to her, why don't you just leave Quincy in the car? She said, you don't like Quincy, do you? I said, I like her enough, but I'm wondering why you love her so much. She's kind of ugly, I said. I asked Leah, why is it that you love her? Because, she said, just because. I do. The novelist George MacDonald delighted in writing about princes and princesses. At the end of his life, he was asked why. Because, he said, if you have the eyes to see it, every boy, every man is a prince. Every girl, every woman is a princess. And in the ancient world, Jesus taught this uniquely, that there are no gradations of the image of God. And for Christ, every person was beloved by God and worth dying for. And there's something happens when we embrace a cross and leave behind our comfort to seek out that remarkable gift that lies within everything God has made. Pray with me. Oh God, this day again, daily, help us to lose our life to our own desires and preference and find it in the things in which you delight. For Christ's sake and in Christ's name, amen.